Chapter 8. Thursday's Reality Confrontations. That is indeed a scary thought. Imagine what might happen in that basement dungeon if the guards could now do whatever they wanted to the prisoners. Imagine what they could do knowing there was no oversight, no one observing their secret games of domination and submission, no one to interfere with their own little mind experiments, which they could play out as wit and whimsy dictated. I'd jump off the convertible couch bed in my upstairs office, wash, dress, and head back down to the basement, glad to have survived that nightmare and to have my own freedom restored. The 2:30 a.m. count is in full swing once again. The seven weary prisoners, awakened once more by loud, shrilling whistles and billy clubs rattling the bars on their stinking, barren cells, are lined up against the wall. Guard Vandy is reciting selected rules and then testing the prisoners' memories of them by delivering assorted punishments for memory lapses. Guard Saros would like the whole experience to be more like a tightly run military prison, so he has the prisoners march in place repeatedly as though they were in the army. After a brief discussion, the two comrades decide that these young men need to be more fully disciplined and to understand the importance of making their beds in the best military fashion. The prisoners are ordered to strip their beds completely and then remake them with precision and stand by them for inspection. Naturally, as in good boot camp style, they all fail the inspection, must re-strip their beds, remake their beds, re-fail inspection, and then repeat the inane process until the guards grow bored with that game. Guard Varnish adds his cute 2 cents. "Okay, men, now that you have made your beds, you can sleep in them until the next count." Remember, this is only day 5 of our experiment. Violence erupts on the yard. Amid the 7 a.m. count and seemingly more carefree singing required of the prisoners, violence suddenly erupts. Prisoner Paul, 5704, exhausted from lack of sleep and irritated at having been singled out for abuse on almost all shifts, strikes back. He refuses to do sit-ups as commanded. Saros insists that the others all continue to do sit-ups without stopping until 5704 agrees to join in. Only by his submission can he stop their painful exercise. Prisoner 5704 does not take the bait. In an extended interview with Kurt Banks, Paul 5704 described his side of this incident and the hostility festering within him. "I've got lousy thigh muscles, and I'm not supposed to stretch them. I told them that, but they said, 'Shut up and do them anyway.' 'Fuck you, you little punk,' I said, while still laying on the ground. As I was getting up to be put in the hole once again, he, Saros, pushed me against the wall. We scuffled, pushing each other hard and yelling. I wanted to swing at him and hit him in the face, but to me that would represent fighting. I'm a pacifist, you know. I just don't think it was in me. But I hurt my foot when we hassled and insisted on seeing a doctor, but was put in the hole instead. I did threaten to flatten him when I got out of the hole, so they kept me in there until all others had breakfast. When they finally let me out of solitary, I was furious and did try to strike that guard, Saros. It took 2 guards to restrain me. As they took me to a separate room for my solo breakfast, I complained about the pain in my foot and asked for a doctor. I did not let the guards examine my foot, since what did they know about it? I ate alone, but did apologize to Varnish, who was least hostile toward me. But the guy I really want to crack is John Wayne, that guy from Atlanta. I'm a Buddhist, and he keeps calling me a communist just to provoke me, and it does. I now think that the good treatment on the part of some guards, like Big Landry, Jeff, is only because they were ordered to act that way." Guard John Landry notes in the daily log that 5704 has been the one most in trouble, or at least he was the most punished prisoner. After each episode, he, 5704, has shown considerable depression, but his spirit, which he calls the freak mentality, continues to rise. He's one of the strongest-willed prisoners. He also refused to wash lunch dishes, so I recommended giving him lousy dinners and curtailed smoking privileges. He has a heavy habit. Consider the following alternate and insightful perspective Guard Saros had of this critical incident and of the psychology of imprisonment in general. One of the prisoners, 5704, was not cooperating at all, so I decided to put him in the hole. By that time it was regular routine. He reacted violently, and I found that I had to defend myself, not as me, but as the guard. He hated me as the guard. He was reacting to the uniform. I felt that was the image he placed on me. I had no choice but to defend myself as a guard. I wondered why the other guards weren't rushing to help me. Everybody was stunned. I realized then that I was as much a prisoner as they were. I was just a reaction to their feelings. They had more of a choice in their actions. I don't think we did. We were both crushed by the situation of oppressiveness, but we guards had the illusion of freedom. I did not see that at the time, or else I would have quit. We all went in as slaves to the money. The prisoners soon became slaves to us. We were still slaves to the money. I realized later that we were all slaves to something in this environment. Thinking of it as just an experiment meant no harm could be done with reality. That was the illusion of freedom. I knew I could quit, but I didn't because I couldn't as a slave to something there. Prisoner Jim, 4325, agreed about the slavish nature of his condition. The worst thing about this experience is the superstructured life and the absolute obedience one must pay to the guards. The humiliation of being almost slaves to the guards is the worst. However, Guard Saros did not let his sense of being trapped in his role interfere with exerting the power of his position. He noted, "I enjoyed bothering them. It bothered me that Sarge, 2093, was so very sheepish. I did make him polish and wax my boots 7 times, and he never complained." In his reflections, Guard Vandy revealed the dehumanizing perception of the prisoners that had crept into his thinking about them. Prisoners were very sheepish by Thursday, except for a brief scuffle between Saros and 5704, which was a small incident of violence that I did not like whatsoever. I thought of them as sheep, and I did not give a damn as to their condition. In Guard Saros's final evaluation report, he offered a different take on the emerging sense of dehumanization by the guards of the prisoners. "There were a few times when I had forgotten the prisoners were people, but I always caught myself, realized that they were people. I simply thought of them as prisoners, losing touch with their humanity. This happened for short periods of time, usually when I was giving orders to them. I am tired and disgusted at times. This is usually the state of my mind. Also, I make an actual try of my will to dehumanize them in order to make it easy for me." Our staff agree that, of all the guards, the one who goes by the book most consistently is Varnish. He is one of the oldest guards, at 24, like Arnett. Both of them are graduate students, so they should have a bit more maturity than the other guards, whose ages range from just 18 for Saros, Vandy, and Jay Landry. Varnish's daily shift reports are the most detailed and lengthy, including accounts of individual incidents of prisoner subordination. Yet he rarely comments on what the guards were doing, and there is no sense of the psychological forces at work in any of these reports. He punishes prisoners only for rule violations, and never arbitrarily. Varnish's role-playing has become so fully internalized that he is the prison guard whenever he is in this prison setting. He is not dramatic and abusive as some others are, like Arnett and Hellman. On the other hand, he is not trying to get the prisoners to like him, as others such as Jeff Landry do. He merely does his job as routinely and efficiently as possible. I see from his background information that Varnish considers himself egotistical at times, with a streak of dogmatism on the side. "There was at times a distinct tendency to minimize effort by not harassing prisoners as much as we could have," Varnish reported. The way in which roles can come to rule not only one's emotions but also one's reason is interestingly revealed in Varnish's self-reflective analysis after the study. I started out in the experiment thinking that I would probably be able to act in a manner appropriate to the experiment, but as the experiment progressed, I was rather surprised to find out that the feelings I had sought to impose on myself were beginning to take over. I was actually beginning to feel like a guard, and had really thought I was incapable of this kind of behavior. I was surprised, no, I was dismayed, to find out that I could really be that I could act in a manner so absolutely unaccustomed to anything I would really dream of doing. And while I was doing it, I didn't feel any regret, I didn't feel any guilt. It was only afterwards, when I began to reflect on what I had done, that this behavior began to dawn on me, and I realized that this was a part of me I had not noticed before. Prisoner 5704 earns more tormenting. Prisoner Paul 5704's assault on Saros was the primary subject of talk in the guard station during the 10 a.m. transfer from the morning to the day shift, when they were taking off or putting on their uniforms to end a shift or start one. They agreed that he would need special attention and discipline, since no such attack against guards could be tolerated. Prisoner 5704 was not included in the 11:30 a.m. count, because he was chained to his bed in cell 1. Guard Arnett ordered everyone else down for 70 push-ups as group punishment for 5704's insubordination. Although the prisoners were getting weaker from their minimal diet and exhausted from lack of sleep, they were nevertheless able to perform this sizable number of push-ups, which I could not do when well-fed and rested. They were getting into athletic condition reluctantly and miserably. Continuing the ironic theme music from the previous day, the prisoners were made to sing, loud and clear, "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning," and "Amazing Grace," mixed in with a choral round of "Row, Row, Row Your Boat." Shortly after he joined his fellows for this chorus, prisoner Paul 5704 continued his verbal insubordination, and once again he was thrown into the hole. Screaming and cursing at the top of his lungs, he again kicked down the wooden partition that separated the two compartments of the hole. The guards dragged him out, handcuffed him, chained both ankles together, and put him back into cell 2 while they repaired the damage to the hole. Solitary now had to have two separate cell units for whenever two prisoners had to be disciplined simultaneously. As inventively determined as real prisoners can be, 5704 somehow was able to take the hinge bolts off the door to his cell, thereby locking himself in and taunting the guards. Once again, the guards broke into his cell and carted him back to the now repaired hole until he was taken to the parole board later that day for a disciplinary hearing. 5704's riotous actions finally break through the appearance of equanimity that Guard Arnett has carefully cultivated. As one of the older guards, a graduate student in sociology, who has tutored in 3 juvenile jails and who has been charged and acquitted for illegal assembly in a civil rights protest, Arnett has the most relevant experience for being a conscientious guard. He is, but without compassion for the prisoners, as he behaves with a completely professional demeanor every moment he is on the yard. He is as precise in delivering his verbal commands as he is in his controlled physical gestures. He has become a high-status authority figure, like a TV anchorman, with his unified movements of head, neck, and shoulders, and his synchronized arm-wrist-hand gestures. Deliberate in word and deed, Arnett conveys a sense of economy of involvement with the scene around him. It is as hard to imagine him being ruffled by anything as it is to imagine anyone challenging him. I am a little surprised myself at the equanimity that I felt throughout. I felt angry only once for a slash when 5704 took the lock off his door and poked me in the stomach with my own stick, which I had just poked him with. At all other times, I felt quite relaxed. I never experienced any sense of power or elation when pushing people or ordering them about. In this prison setting, Arnett used his understanding of some social science research to his advantage. I was aware from my reading that boredom and other aspects of prison life can be exploited to make people feel disoriented by being impersonal, giving boring work, punishing all prisoners for bad behavior by individuals, demeaning perfect execution of trivial demands in exercise sessions. I was sensitive to the power of those in control of social settings, and I tried to heighten alienation of the prisoners by using some of these techniques. I could use it only in a very limited way because I didn't want to be brutal. In challenging the early parole release for 5704, Arnett wrote to the board, "I can hardly list all 5704's infractions at this time. He is constantly and grossly insubordinate, with flare-ups of violence and extreme mood swings, and constantly tries to incite the other prisoners to insubordination and general uncooperativeness. He acts badly even when he knows punishment for the other prisoners will result. He should be dealt with harshly by the discipline committee." Prisoner 416 confronts the system with a hunger strike. Prisoner 5704 wasn't the only disciplinary concern. The madness of this place, to which we have become accustomed over the few days since we began last Sunday, had also struck Prisoner 416 when he arrived yesterday as a replacement prisoner for first-to-be-released Prisoner Doug, 8612. He could not believe what he was witnessing and wanted to quit the experiment immediately. However, he was told by his cellmates that he could not quit. His cellmates passed along the false statement that Prisoner 8612 had asserted, that it was not possible to leave, that they would not allow anyone to leave before the time was up. I'm reminded of the famous line from the song Hotel California, "You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave." Instead of challenging that false assertion, Prisoner 416 would use a passive means of escape. "I developed a plan," he later said. "I would insist on the loophole in my hastily prepared contract. But what force beyond pleading could I exert on this system? I could rebel as Paul 5704 has, but by using legal tactics to get out, my feelings were of secondary importance, though I followed them in terms of achieving my goal. Instead, I chose to exhaust the resources of this simulation by being impossible, by refusing all rewards and accepting their punishments." It is unlikely that 416 realized that he was adopting a strategy that organized labor had used in struggles against management, to play by the rules, formerly known as work to rule, on every matter in order to expose inherent weaknesses in the system. 416 decided to go on a fast because, by refusing the food the guards offered, he would take away one source of their power over the prisoners. Looking at his skinny body, his muscle-free body, 135 pounds on a 5'8" frame, made me think that he already looked like a starvation victim. In some ways, Clay, 416, was more powerfully impacted by his first day as a prisoner in the Stanford County Jail than anyone else was, as he told us in this personal yet depersonalized analysis. "I began to feel that I was losing my identity. The person I call Clay, the person who put me in this place, the person who volunteered to go into this prison, because it was a prison to me, it still is a prison to me, I don't look on it as an experiment or a simulation. It is a prison run by psychologists instead of run by the state. I began to feel that identity, the person I was, that decided to go to prison, was distant from me, was remote, until finally I wasn't that. I was 416. I was really my number, and 416 was going to have to decide what to do, and that was when I decided to fast. I decided to fast because that was the one reward the guards gave you. They always threatened they wouldn't let you eat, but they had to give you eats, and so I stopped eating. Then I had a sort of power over something because I found the one thing they couldn't crack me on. They were going to catch shit eventually if they didn't get me to eat. And so I was sort of humiliating them by being able to fast." He began by refusing to touch his lunch. Arnett reported that he overheard 416 telling his cellmates that he intended not to eat until he got the legal consultation that he had been demanding. He said that, "After about 12 hours, I'll probably collapse. And then what can they do? They'll have to give in." Arnett found him nothing more than a sassy and back-talking prisoner. He sees nothing noble in this hunger strike. Here was a new prisoner embarking on a daring plan of disobedience, directly challenging the guard's power. His act could potentially make him a nonviolent hero around whom the prisoners could rally, someone to rouse them from their mindlessly obedient stupor, like Mahatma Gandhi. By contrast, it is clear that the violence used by 5407 did not work in a place where the resources of power are so imbalanced in favor of the system. I was hoping that 416 would come up with another plan that would involve his cellmates and the others in communal disobedience, using a mass hunger strike as a tactic for remediation of their harsh treatment. Nevertheless, I worried that he was so internally focused that he had little awareness of the need to engage his fellows in fuller group opposition. Two more prisoners break down. It appeared that the problem caused by 5407 and 416 were the beginnings of a domino effect of confrontations. Prisoner 1037's mother had been right. Her son, Rich, had not looked good to her. Now he did not look good to me. He had become increasingly depressed after his folks had left following visiting hours. He probably wished that they had insisted on taking him home with them. Instead of accepting his mother's accurate appraisal of his condition, Rich probably came to believe that his masculinity was at stake. He wanted to prove that he could take it, like a man. He couldn't. Just like his cellmates, 8612 and 819 from the original rebellious cell 2, 1037 displayed symptoms of extreme stress to such an extent that I had him taken to the quiet room outside the prison yard and told him that it would be best if he were paroled at this time. He was pleased and surprised at this good news. As I helped him change into his civilian clothes, he was still shaky. I told him he would get full pay for the entire experiment and that we would be in contact with him and all the other students soon to go over the results of the study, complete the final surveys, and give them their payment. Prisoner 1037 later said that the worst part of the experiment was the time when the guards gave me the feeling that they were expressing their true inner feelings and not just the guard role they were playing. For example, there were some times during the exercise periods when we prisoners would be pushed to the point of real suffering. Some guards seemed to really enjoy our agony. When his parents came to get him during visiting hours, the news of 1037's imminent parole did not go down well with prisoner 4325, who was more stressed than any of us had realized. Big Jim, as our research team referred to 4325, seemed like a self-assured young man whose pre-selection assessment had indicated he was in the normal range on all measures. Nevertheless, on that afternoon, he abruptly broke down. "When the appearance before the parole board came up, I immediately became hopeful of getting released. But I fell a long way down when Rich, 1037, was paroled and I was not. That one act worked its way into me and brought about an even heavier feeling of desperation. I broke as a result. I learned that my emotions are much more present than I thought and realized what a great life I actually have. If prison is anything like what I went through here, I don't know how it could help anyone." I said the same things to him as I had said to 1037. Namely, that we were going to parole him soon anyway for his good behavior, and that it was fine if he left sooner. I thanked him for his participation, told him I was sorry that it had been so tough on him, and invited him back soon to discuss what we found. I wanted to have all the students come back together to share their reactions after having had a bit of distance from this unusual experience. He gathered his belongings and left quietly after indicating that he did not need to see a psychological counselor in student health services. The warden's log noted, 4325 reacts badly and has to be released by 5:30 p.m. because of severe reactions like those displayed by 819, Stu, and 8612, Doug, before him. The log also adds the curious fact that there is no mention of 4325's release by any of the prisoners or by any of the guards. Gone and forgotten. Rest in peace. Apparently, by this time in the grueling test of endurance, all that matters is who is present and accounted for, not who used to be. Out of sight is definitely out of mind. Letters home from the Stanford Jail. Today, when the prisoners were writing letters home explaining what a fine time they were having, as they have done before, prisoner 5486, Jerry, could not get his letter right until the third attempt, reported guard Marcus. This prisoner's behavior and respect for authority have been steadily deteriorating from the early days when he was in the model cell number 3. Since cell realignment, 5486 has been adversely affected by his new cellmates, and his behavior is now characterized by his new wisecracks, especially during counts. All of his behaviors have the sole purpose to undermine prison authority. Arnett's report also singled out this formerly model prisoner as a new problem. 5486 has been in gradual downhill slide since being separated from 4325 and 2093 in cell number 3. He has become something of a jokester and minor cut-up. This unacceptable behavior should be rectified before leading to committing something serious. The third guard on the day shift, John Landry, was similarly upset when 5486 made a joke out of letter writing as a sign of his general non-cooperation. I recommend, as punishment, that he be made to write 15 letters of this type. Christina joins the Mad Hatter's party. After Thursday's parole board and disciplinary board finished their deliberations, Carlo had to return to the city for urgent business. I was glad that I did not have to take him to dinner, because I wanted to be present for the early visiting hours scheduled for right after the prisoners had their dinner. I had to apologize to Mrs. Y., prisoner 1037's mother, for my insensitive behavior the other night. However, I also wanted to have a more relaxed dinner that night with the newcomer to those deliberations, Christina Maslach. Christina had recently gotten her Ph.D. in social psychology at Stanford and was about to begin her career as an assistant professor at Berkeley, one of the first women to be hired by its psychology faculty in decades. She was a diamond in the smooth, smart, serene, and self-contained. Hardworking and committed to a career as a research psychologist and educator, Christina had worked with me earlier as a teaching assistant and a valuable research collaborator, as well as an informal editor of several of my books. I imagine that I would have been in love with her even if she had not been stunningly beautiful. For a poor kid from the Bronx, this elegant California girl was a dream come true. However, I had to maintain a respectful distance so that my recommendations for her employment would not be tainted by my personal involvement. Now that she had gotten one of the best jobs in the country on her own merits, we could pursue our relationship openly. I had not told her much about this prison study because she and some other colleagues and graduate students were scheduled to do a thorough evaluation of the staff, prisoners, and guards the next day, Friday, about halfway through our scheduled 2 weeks. I had the sense that she had not been pleased by what she had seen and heard on the afternoon of the disciplinary deliberations. It was not anything she had said that disturbed me, but her saying nothing at all. We would discuss her reactions to Carlo and that scenario at our late dinner, as well as the kind of information I hoped she could obtain from her interviews on Friday. The priest follows through on his promise of pastoral aid. The priest, who knows that this is just a simulated prison, has already done his part to add verisimilitude to this mock prison by his seriously intense role-playing the other day. Now he is forced to follow through on his priestly promise to give aid should anyone request his assistance. Sure enough, Father McDermott calls the mother of hubby, 7258, and tells Mrs. Whitlow that her son needs legal representation if he wants to get out of the Stanford County Jail. Instead of just saying that if her son really wants out so badly, she will just take him back home with her when she sees him at the next visitor's night, Mrs. W. does what she is told. She calls her nephew, Tim, a lawyer in the public defender's office. He, in turn, calls me, and we follow through on this script by agreeing to schedule his official lawyer's visit for Friday morning as one more realistic element in this experience that is growing ever more unreal. Our little drama, it would appear, is now being rewritten by Franz Kafka as a surreal supplement to The Trial, or perhaps by Luigi Pirandello as an update of his Il Fumatia Pascal, or his better-known play, Six Characters in Search of an Author.